Okay, let's bow our heads. Our dear Father in heaven, it's an honor to be able to come before your presence, and it's even more of an honor that you have called us your friends, and the reason we're your friends is because you are willing to tell us everything you know. Well, we know we can't absorb everything we know, you know, but we ask for the Holy Spirit to help us to understand the little bits that we can understand, and especially be with us here today as we're going to look at some rather interesting information. In thy name, amen. Okay, we're going to get rolling because there's a lot of material. You're jumping in the middle of this. It's a long story why we're going with number three, but we are, and I'm not going to bore you with it. So there is a lot of information that's already come in lectures one and two, and this goes for 13 lectures, so you can see where we are in the process. But each one of these topics carries a little, puts another brick in the building so we can see what's really been done, what I believe has been done to us by the adversary. I think we've greatly underestimated what has occurred. And especially what's very important is the first lecture where I talk about information theory. Well, actually, it's the second lecture where I talk about information theory. And just a small synopsis, most of your cosmology scientists, the physicists that are leading the way now, all agree that the universe at its most basic level is constructed of information. But the information is ubiquitous. There's nothing in the universe that doesn't have information, and information has to, from our perspective, we can only pick up the information if it's traveling with electromagnetic energy or mass, or it's on mass. So if we're talking about the devil hijacking the human race, where we have to look for is in the field of information. You can look at other fields to try to get where you want to go, but chances are it's going to be murky, and you are going to have what appears to be conflicts. And if you go with information theory, and I can tell you I've been looking at this now for over 8 years, all of the discrepancies fade away, and it fits in what I believe to be very perfectly, very sharp, and very clear. Okay, this we're looking at. The information we're talking about is you and I all have an information system. We call it our DNA or our genome. And the genome means more than just the DNA. It means all of the proteins and enzymes that accompany it and are needed for its functioning. And so I like to refer to it as the genome because the DNA alone, which we used to think was so important, is now becoming less and less relevant. It's the stuff that comes with it that makes all the difference. You need the DNA to begin with, to be sure, but it's more like the DNA is the piano keys on a piano. The piano player makes the difference. The piano can't do anything without the player, and the player determines whether you're going to have Mozart or you're going to have honky-tonk or you're going to have rock and roll. So you see, the same piano keys can play all of those. It's the player that matters, and the player in this case is what, in this paradigm, has been taken over by the other side. He is playing the keys. He's the maestro sitting at the bench playing the piano. This was from lecture two. There is no evolutionary origin of mobile genetic elements. Because this is supposed to be the review part of this lecture, I'd love to go on at this. This is very fascinating, but this is a very important point. There's no way you can come to mobile genetic elements with any known evolutionary theory using DNA or any other RNA or any other information system. And I've got multiple quotes from very, very, very prestigious geneticists that say that. Hallmark genes are totally unique in our biome and cannot have evolved from genes within the living cells. Paul revert earlier, talking about the lines, usually line-1, if you're going to look this up on Google. The line-1 are very large, cumbersome mobile genetic elements that can be thousands of base pairs long. And they bring in the code for things like reverse transcriptases, which means you now can take RNA and transcribe DNA from it. That capability is not present in any living cell. You only can be brought in by these line ones, okay? And there is no enzyme in the cell that can approximately become close enough that you could say, well, it might have changed and you know, switched over to the dark side. It's a completely new engineered product entirely. And the interesting thing is, it's very poorly engineered. When you look at the other enzymes in the body, it's sloppy. But so is the endonucleases and the integrases. Once you make the reverse, once you take RNA and you make a DNA template from it, you have to find a way to get it into the DNA, and so the endonucleases go in and they make surgical incisions at an exact spot, and then the integrase takes that DNA and puts it into the cell. If you don't have those three enzymes, which are totally mobile genetic element, no one's arguing this, there's no other ways to find them, unless you have those enzymes, this attack on the human using retro elements, which are RNA, and you know, we have RNA viruses and things of that nature, without those, you can't, they would do nothing to our genome. You have to have those three. There's others involved, but I just limited it to three. They are all completely unique in the biome. There is nothing like them anywhere. They have a different author, because it's not evolution. So if we all went from an evolutionary point, it came from somewhere else. No one knows exactly where, and it is a source of debate, because people don't know. Viruses have to elude 50 body defenses in infecting a human cell. If the viruses were somehow something that broke away from the human cell and then through environmental selection somehow became malevolent to the cell and started to attack it, you wouldn't have, it would have a much easier time. You wouldn't have the cell set up with 50 different mechanisms to try to stop these viruses from coming in. Evolutionary, again, that doesn't work. I can't spend a lot of time here. I'd like to, but I've got plenty of fare to go. So the cell is a constant war with mobile genetic elements, and it does this for the life. And you're going to find out today, mobile genetic elements are the cause of everything we don't like in our life. Everything. That's a big statement, and we're only going to be able to look at a number of things in depth, but truly, this topic here today, and don't worry, I'm not going to do it. I could talk for 8 hours and just showing you studies and papers. And even then, we would just be doing a precursory job. Life on Earth is composed of a multitude of cellular organisms, some of them being as tiny as bacteria, others as complex as humans, yet the cellular way of living is overwhelmed in both number and genetic diversity by non-cellular entities, each of which is capable of enforcing cellular organisms to fulfill their selfish needs. A word virus is a Latin term for poison, commonly refers to the strategy for survival. They are. The human genome is comprised of original genetic material and virus-like genetic segments. They've been come under the name of transposable elements, but mobile genetic elements has been the term that's been used a lot in the last 3 or 4 years. Transposable elements were used earlier. Prior to that, it was junk DNA, and then it was jumping DNA. The person who discovered this was Barbara McClintock in about 1948, published around 1951. She called them controlling elements, and she was spot on. That's what they are. They are the controlling elements. They are the guy in the analogy with the piano. They're the guy sitting at the piano, playing the piano keys. And the piano keys, we used to refer to, the old term is genes. Now it's protein coding segments. I'm going to still use the word gene because you're used to it. And the other one takes a long time to say. So I just wanted you to know, if you want to be right up with genetics, you're going to use the word protein coding segment or instead of gene now, because the concept of a gene is pretty much gone. And Mendelian genes, the whole way that is gone. That was a way to try to describe it, much like Newton described gravity, and then you get theory of relativity, and now you understand that's the difference when you're using the word with Mendelian genetics compared to what we know now. So the word gene is, if you read in the literature in the last couple of years, it's not there. It's protein coding segment. All of the authors now agreed about 66% of our genome wasn't there when on the original. It was added. But the guy by the name of Robert Shapiro out of Chicago, who is an excellent geneticist, been writing wonderful papers for over 40 years, puts the number at 85%, and he gives some very compelling arguments as to why that's the case. And I think he's right. He is spot on. So we'll stop and think for a moment. The information system that determines who you are and who I am, let's go conservative, 66% of it was not in the original. And the problem is, not only was 66 not in the original, but there was a lot of the original that's not there. It's replaced it. So it's not just been adding more information, it's been adding information as it's been deleting it. In other words, a master editor has come in and has gone into the information system, which from which we come, and has done some, well, has done a makeover. You're going to have to listen to the other lectures to lecture two to go. Pseudogenes are, 8% of the genome is made up of pseudogenes. Pseudogenes, the word pseudo means that it's not real. That's correct. Either these genes were brought in by mobile genetic elements in total, or the mobile genetic elements have infested genes that were originally there and so remade the code that you can't even, whatever it transcribes is either non-functional or has a totally new function. And I'm going to put this in perspective for you. The amount of protein coding areas that are we all used to call genes, it's now less than 2% of the genome. So 8% of the protein coding areas that for proteins are new, added, altered. We only have less than 2% of the original. Non-protein coding segments, that's about the 98%. The ENCODE project, which was published in June of 2007 in Nature magazine, came out with a blockbuster. It says the stuff that's between the 98%+ that's not protein coding is not junk after all. It's not vestiges of old evolutionary debris. It's all, 80% is transcribed, and they said, we think all of it is. Well, this has caused a huge brouhaha because the evolutionists have pointed with pride to this old junk DNA that's just been carried around as remnants of past evolutionary way stations. It was not true. It's all transcribed. Well, they say 80%. I'm going to jump out and tell you, I think it's all transcribed, and a lot of authors are hinting that it is all transcribed. And it's regulatory. It's the guy on the piano bench who's playing the piano. That's the important thing. That's the difference between us and a chimpanzee. They will tell you that we're only, we're 98%. Well, actually, it's now dropped to 95%. And if you really look at it carefully, it's probably less than 66%. But the difference between us and a chimpanzee, we can argue about how much their similarities. The differences is our regulatory, the 98%+ that's regulatory, makes a completely different organism. That's the difference. Many of the genes that we have and they have are the same, protein coding areas. It's the guy who, it's the instructions and how they're to be put together that make the difference. And that's where these mobile genetic elements have gone. Promoters, the promoter is another way of saying, if you have an automobile, if you go to the driver's seat, you have the steering wheel, you have the gear shift, the accelerator, the brake, and the ignition. The promoter does all of those functions. So in order for the gene to work, it's got to have the promoter. And without the promoter, it's not going to work. 75% of all promoters are either completely brought in by mobile genetic elements, or they have so infested them that they have completely changed them over. Do I think they're going to get closer to 100%? Yes, I do. But they can't make that statement yet because they haven't looked at them. So if you own the promoter, you own, and I'm using the old term, if you own the promoter, you own the gene. And we know for a fact that mobile genetic elements own 75% of the promoters. So you're starting to get the scale of the hijacking here. And the intergenetic insertions, They're actually the protein coding areas that we still think are relatively unmolested. Right in the middle of it, you'll find something, and most of them called an intron. Now, the intron may have, we think introns were always there, but what happens is the mobile genetic elements love to get into the introns, and the introns are giving instructions to the editing enzymes that come in once the transcription is done to edit it and make it prepared to go out to the cell where it's translated into a protein. The introns are very important because they will even do such things. They are the promoter will tell you where that mobile messenger RNA, which ribosome in the cell it's to go to, and a chaperone protein takes it out. And I mean it's a very highly controlled, completely programmed exercise. And if there's nothing there, if something is there that isn't right, the whole thing falls apart and doesn't go forward. I just thought this was interesting. This just was one out of 500 little factlets about this that I thought that I find very interesting. But I'm to this crowd, this is probably going to mean something more than it would to maybe a different audience that I've talked to. And that is the tissue-specific expression of human salivary amylase is controlled. Endogenous retrovirus, that's another name in this mobile genetic element family. Okay. Insertion that may have helped our forebears to switch from a mainly fruit-based diet to one containing starch. I want to argue that the change was made when they left the garden, and God had to make the change in the diet because of what was coming down the line with programming. Mobile genetic elements are not random within the brain genome, especially, and again, I've got to really try to be succinct. We talked briefly about the lineup over here. The line LINE-1s were one of the main assault troops that came in. If you look at mobile genetic elements in general, 80% are clustered near or on protein coding areas that code for enzymes and other proteins for the central nervous system. They are very scarce in the parts of the different organs where they're not open. They're not an open reading frame. They're not transcribed. But we're going to see that in a moment. And plus, their numbers are down. They flourish in the neural progenitor cells. That's where they're going to go in the fetus, and they go there in droves, and they set up camp. And if you take, for instance, a human line-1, and you go into a cat embryo, and make it a transgenic cat by putting that in, it will go and nest near the protein coding areas for the cat CNS. And they're on different chromosomes. These have been engineered. They know exactly where they're going. How do we do genetic engineering today? There's a couple of companies, and one especially in China, which get this select mobile genetic elements, and they will, using the mobile genetic element as a vehicle, much like we used to use the space shuttle to take payloads up, they can now deliver almost within 100 nucleotides or less of where you want to deliver in a genome, human genome. They've got the right mobile genetic element to take it in. These things are very programmed, and we use the word cruise missile, and we use the word over here smart bomb and things like that. They know where they're going. They actually can, and it's not clear how they're able to discern exactly the neighborhood, but they can. What is the result of the T's on the genome? Well, this is just a small little shopping list that I'm going to give you today. Each one of these, again, on mental illness, we could be here 2 hours, 2.5 hours. I'm not doing this as a threat. I'm just trying to give you an idea that this is very complex, and it's very well researched. It's not a mystery. Selfish behavior, that one we're going to look at today, because of all the ones I'm going to put up here, this is number 2 is the one I think most of you are going to go, oh no, come on, I can buy the others, but I'm not going to buy that. So we are going to spend some time on this one. Endocrine diseases, they're very simple, very easy. genetic diseases, of course, that would seem like a no-brainer after what I've told you. Autoimmune diseases, there's not one autoimmune disease that doesn't have mobile genetic elements as its etiological base that we know of. Cancer is a mobile genetic element problem, period. Aging, we're going to talk about that today because you're going to have to see how that works. And then death. The death we're talking about today, since we're all here in a biblical situation, is the first death. It programs in the first death. Everyone in this room is on a absolutely predetermined timer in your information system. And you are going to expire before the year of 120 years old, because that's what the timer is maximally set for. And I would love to talk about that with you for a while. And go read Genesis, where he says, I'm going to only deal with man for 120 years. We thought, well, that's what Noah had to talk to the antediluvians. But I'm going to suggest to you that I think his first meaning was, from now on, man's going to live to be 120. And there's incredibly interesting scientific evidence that shows we can't go past that. There is a stop codon.
Done.
Someone got to be 124 recently, or 126, and it was absolutely fanfared around the world. The trouble is that person's birth certificate and where they were born is very questionable, and we're using a lot of second and third generation sources. So whether they were 126 or 121 or 120 is open to debate. Let's go. I'm going to throw some stuff up here. We're not going to talk about the papers. We're just going to look them up there. Human obesity, ALUs. You saw that name over here. Autoimmunity. This was a long paper, and I'm putting these here because you can access them later on the internet, and you can look them up yourselves. I'm trying to throw you some resource papers that you can go to the bibliography and really get into this if you wish. Colorectal cancers. Cancer is one easy place to mobile genetic elements are just, it's very easy to see who's caused it and how, and it's them. This one's not at all difficult to elucidate. And then all you need to know, this bottom one, Seminars in Cancer Biology, it was printed in, I lost my glasses this morning, so I'm trying to find a focal length. And it's in red there. Can you read it? I can't. It's in red. 2012. There we go. I'm going to have to look up the screen whether I want to or not. So it's very fairly new. It's a great one if you're looking for a... Okay. I've got to talk on this for a minute because I find this fascinating. Mobile genetic elements not only cause the cancer, but they go to great lengths to make sure that surrounding cells will receive the new information too. It's a very well thought out, complex chess game with the cell that it goes and knocks out the multiple defenses that the cell has against this. The first thing it knocks out is the cell's trigger to undergo apoptosis. Apoptosis is a programmed cell death. At the end of the cell's life, it actually goes through a capsase genes 1 through 12. It actually goes through a very capsase gene 1 hits 2, 4. It goes right down the line. It packages up the cell, gets all the good things that are possibly can be used by other cells, and then it turns out the light and lets the stuff go out in packets, and it's used by neighboring cells, and a new cell comes in to take its place. Well, that in and alone of itself should stop cancer from occurring. So that has to be turned off, and that's the first thing they do is they go and they turn off the capsase system. That's the information that goes out in little microvesicles from the tumor cells to go to neighboring tumor cells, and we're going to see here for a moment, to other cells throughout the body to turn off that system. If that system's on, you can't have cancer. But it gets even better. The new idea that they're looking at from metastasis is different. When I was in medical school, and most of my life as a physician, the idea of metastasis was, for instance, let's use breast cancer. You get a breast tumor. Some of the cells break off into the bloodstream, and they go lodge in the lung or in the bone marrow. And they set up housekeeping, and they start to grow. And of course, a lot of pharmacological research is going into the ability to call in red blood cells, the special system that does that. And because I figure if we can do that, we can not only stop the tumor, but we could stop metastasis. But the recent information coming out is that that's the authors here are presenting what I think is very interesting evidence that metastasis could very well be something different. The tumor cells, let's use breast again, sends out multiple microvesicles throughout the body. We used to think that all of the cells in an organ were simply one died, the neighbor decided, okay, one's dead, there's an open space here, I'll divide and we'll make up the difference. Especially in the brain, but in the liver and other organs, that's not the way it happens. Most of the time what happens is you have stem cells at the pluripotent stage who are sitting up there waiting for a vacancy, and then they get called in and they use the word differentiated into a liver cell, or if it's in the bone marrow, into one of the progenitors of the blood component, or if it's in the brain, neurons. And that's, by the way, where alcohol gets into the brain, and it stops those progenitor cells from being able to go in and take over the spot of a dead neuron, or if you're making a memory, to make a new neuron. So that would be an interesting discussion of itself when you get into the genetics. It's alcohol, I will tell you right now, is not good for you. I don't care what the press says. They're playing with the data, but let's leave that aside. So what happens with this breast cell? It sends out these microvesicles, which are filled with microRNAs, the non-coding segments of RNA that are going to go into the new cell and have reverse transcriptase, which is provided for them by the line dash ones, so it can make the DNA that can go into the cell and take it over. But most of the time now they're finding that the epigenetic elements, primarily microRNAs and silencing RNAs and that whole family, which in this lecture series is talked about in lectures 8, 9, and 10, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through that, are really the masters. They are they're calling the shots in the cell when it comes to the genome, probably more than any of the other elements we're talking about. That's what's in these microvesicles. And they go to, let's say they go to the brain. And what they do is they're picked up, they preferentially look for these pluripotent stem cells, and they go into the pluripotent stem cells, and they provide the information to make that pluripotent stem cell differentiate into a breast cancer cell and start dividing.
So it's really a viral infection.
It's real. Well, it's an information infection. These aren't viruses, but it's an information. They have gone and reprogrammed these cells that are very, very, very open to be programmed, because they're sitting now. Pluripotent cell can go in maybe 80% of the body's different cell types. It can become. As you get down the stem cell, it becomes, as they differentiate them more and more, there's different names and classes, and finally you get to the final, where you are a hepatocyte, and that's it for life, for the rest of that cell's life. So, and I believe that this has great promise. It now makes sense why you are going to go mainly to organs which are heavily dependent upon stem cells to regenerate the dead cells that they're in. And you know, if you can, bone marrow, brain, liver. And then, so anyway, can't spend any longer, I got to keep going. I just said that. Psychosis, autism, post-traumatic stress syndrome, manic depressive, It is fascinating. I'm just going to tell you, mobile genetic elements are in their element, pun intended, in all of these areas. If 80% of the mobile genetic elements are affecting primarily protein coding areas which deal with the CNS, should it be a shock that we're going to have this problem? This is just a laundry list of, I found a paper that started to just give some of the most, you know, like you have a top 10 list. Well, these are the top 10 diseases, only it's the top 100. And just telling you which one of the mobile genetic elements are involved and where. This is something for you to peruse at your convenience. We're not going to spend a lot of time today, except I am going to look at one of those. We're going to be talking about this in a little bit. Notice here where it says breast cancer, BRCA2 and BRCA1, these are all mobile genetic element driven. The ALU-YA5, that's the name of the ALU, and we're going to meet up with it later in the talk, and I'm just bringing it to your attention now. You're going to find out it's linked in another way. Now on to a cheerier topic, aging and death. About 4 years ago, maybe it was three, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, Deepak Chopra, did I pronounce it correctly for those of you who may know it?
Is that Deepak Chopra?
Deepak. I got Deepak. Okay, it's Deepak Chopra. Was on Good Morning America, and he was waxing eloquently about his book at the time. And the name of the book, I don't recall, but I do know that the main gist of the book was that death is okay. It's all right. It's part of living. We need to realize that we need to be mature about it. We need to realize that this is a very, it's an acceptable thing. We need to be mature about this and realize that his point was, it's just as good as being born, it's good to die. And I thought, well, I wonder if he'd be saying that if we got a phone call on the set that one of his children had been killed. Would he be still singing from the same songbook? Paul makes it very clear in 1 Corinthians 15 that death is an enemy. It is an absolute enemy. Well, anyway, Deepak Chopra. He made his point. He talked about some rabbis who were talking. This was way back in, from the Talmud. They were talking, and they said, well, they had gone and talked to God, and God had said, you can have a choice. Either you can have children and have procreate, or you don't have children and you live forever. Which would you choose? And the rabbis went and talked and debated, and they came back and they said, we choose children. Well, here's the fallacy of that whole thing. And what just irritates me is God says, you can have both. There is no one or the other. The idea was we were to have both. There is no excuse for death. Death is wrong. It is an enemy. We should be outraged at it, but we've all grown up with it, and we've got to come to us accept the fact that it's just natural. It's normal. If you see what mobile genetic elements do to bring on death, it makes you angry. We have been hijacked. This is a high crime against the original coder. So let's go ahead and start going down this happy pathway. Death is a consequence of aging, so that's why I put them together. You can't have one, you can have one without the other. You can be hit by a car, you can have an infectious disease, or things of those nature. But if you're going to have an organism that is allowed to have the basics for life all the way, it will age and it will die, and it will die because of the aging process. So we're going to look at the aging here. This is an important piece of information we're going to go with from here for the next couple of slides. Because each biomolecule generates specific forms of damage, the cumulative damage is largely non-random and is indirectly encoded in the genome. And if you notice, the title is The Origin of Aging, Imperfectness driven non-random damage defines the aging process, defines the aging process and control of lifespan. So it's programmed in, is what they're saying here. And it says inevitable damage, biological imperfectness is the reason the damage is inevitable. So that's the, we're going to be, this is the drum I'm going to be beating on here more. I'm just bringing it to your attention. And that the damage is non-random. And so it's not, going back to addressing the idea that these mobile genetic elements are like cannon fodder that were put in one of these old cannons and aimed at the target and it exploded and you hope some of the shrapnel got to where you wanted it to, but you blasted it across the spectrum hoping some would hit. This is not what we're talking here at all, because we all age in exactly the same way. And it is programmed in at the genetic level. Again, number nine, the damage is genetically encoded. The origin, the damage generation, clearance, dilution strategy operated ever since the first cellular organisms and is rooted so deeply in metabolism that it is an essential part of cellular life. What he's saying there is the inefficiencies that have been brought into the system are embedded everywhere through the basic metabolic pathways that we have in our cells. So there's no escaping it. And this just goes through it again, shows you that. And trying to make it a easier to understand, if I got a pointer here. Okay, I love these. You have substrate A plus substrate B, and you have an enzyme in here, and you get product C and product D. And this is, obviously you can have many more on both substrate and products and whatever, but we're just looking at the general concept. What happens with is the fact that these enzymes are slightly or either slightly or in, on a continuum up to greatly defective in their original, in their amino acid sequence, so that the active sites that are present to do the job that are they're supposed to do are slightly deformed. And that slightly change in the way that the enzyme is constructed makes, for instance, that it doesn't use all of substrate A or substrate B, or maybe there's a substrate C. This part here is not completely taken into the system and brought made into this. And what happens then is these substrates can go into other metabolic pathways because they start to build up in the cell, and these other metabolic, when their concentration gets high enough, they can enter other pathways, and the result of those pathways is something which is deleterious to the cell. Reactive oxygen species would be a really good example of this, ROS. And there's no way, save changing this, that you're going to get away from that problem. There are also instances where the enzyme is sufficiently malformed that the products over here are not exactly the way they're supposed to be. These products being slightly different than what they were originally engineered to look like, have trouble then meeting, going into other metabolic pathways in the cell. And they start to build up. And I can't go into it, it's a little more detailed than this, but amyloid, beta amyloid, should come, if you're thinking of Alzheimer's disease, is a case in point. But it's a malformed protein, and there's more to it. But it comes from this concept. Genomes if you look at a senescent cell, that's an aging cell. What the cell starts to do is it begins to slowly decrease its normal daily activities and its normal functions. And if you get a thyroid cell that is getting older, it starts to make less T4, T3, things of that nature. The reason why this happens is they undergo epigenetic changes, without going into a long dissertation of what those epigenetic changes are, I will just tell you that those epigenetic changes are actually coded for in the non-coding section. Remember the 98% I talked about? And they are 100% mobile genetic origin. It says the levels of this repression are also variable among the sensitive individuals. What these epigenetic elements do is they start repressing the normal coding functions of the DNA and open reading frames and parts of the DNA where the cell is actively transcribing to perform the activities it's going to do. They start to shut them down. They start to lock them up, and the process is something 90% plus is through the methylation through the CpG part of the chromosome, and then histone protein binding around it, and it becomes that part of the genome is no longer available for any transcribing or any activity. It's locked up. It's gone. And so you start locking up crucial areas of the cell. You can understand what's going to happen. The cell is going to get into trouble, and if you continue to do that, it will die. I probably should have made this my last slide on this, but I foolishly went on because I think it's interesting how that happens. Overall, these data confirm the presence of a number of new retrotransposon-derived epi alleles with suggestions of the presence of more and further identity of retrotransposons. Anytime you see any retrotransposon or transposon, you're immediately talking mobile genetic element. As a major source of epigenetic variations in the mammalian genome. Just very quickly, when you look at this slide, you see ferrets, formaldehyde-assisted isolation of repetitive elements. If you look at here, you see this is early, this is a young cell, and this is a senescent cell. When you look at a young cell, this is L stands for line-1s. Line-1s, by the way, are 17% of the genome. They're the largest contributor of mobile genetic elements, and they were the first landing party, in my opinion. Notice that in a young cell, there is very little of the elements that are actually controlling the cell. The cell has got most of the retro elements under control. As you get older, the retro elements are no longer under control, and they now take over the cell. They take over the genome, and they take over telling it what it's going to do, even if what it's told to do is to actually be very deleterious to the cell. If you look here to RNA expression, that's another word, most of these mobile genetic elements are retro elements, which means that you transcribe off from the DNA which are in the cell, are in the genome, you transcribe off RNA, and that RNA is either with reverse transcriptase made back into DNA to go elsewhere in the cell. It's a copy and paste type of idea. Or the RNA goes out, which is, in this case, the big thing. It goes out and it now changes. It becomes the editor of all the other transcribed messenger RNA that's coming out of the cell. It edits it. It changes it. It cuts it. It rearranges it. It's a controlling element. So everything now that cell, even if a certain protein coding area is left untouched and it's doing transcribing exactly perfectly, the editors are waiting for the messenger RNA, and they will change it into a completely different form, and I'm talking teleologically here, if they so choose. They are the final editors. And this last one here is transposition. Transposition is just, that's where jumping genes come from. That means moving a position in the DNA. If you look at the retro elements, they do it by a copy and paste, and the old transposons or transposases, which were the very first vanguard to bring in the cell, they're called the ancient mobile genetic elements. They do it by a cut and paste. So they work a little bit different. But either one of those two activities, the transposases, by and large, aren't functioning anymore. They are relics. But so they look at transposition or retrotransposition as a sign that these areas of the genome which before had been locked down to keep these mobile genetic elements quiet, that the lockdown is failing. And now as they become, as the locks come off, the inmates start taking over the asylum. And so as you see in a early, there is no jumping around. As you get older, it starts to increase, and in late senescence, they have control. They're totally without any, there are no brakes on the system. I'm going to go through these very quickly because I think I've touched on most of this already. And they're somewhat technical. Let's just move on. This is the first death. This is a great, my term, not the author's. Those are my words up there. As the cell gets older, it gets to a point where it's in a senescence response. And the initiation of the senescence response occurs. And you begin to trigger off, put the capsaic system on alert that we may have to undergo an apoptosis. So the cell now is having trouble doing its daily functions, and it's fascinating how the cell is able to figure it out. But again, it has to do with epigenetic elements, and this is, therefore, it should not be a shock to you that if when you go into cancer, if you have epigenetic elements are what tell the cell you're getting older, we need to shut you down. If you make a new set of epigenetic elements that say, no, no, this is just fine, keep going, in fact, gear up, and those new instructions become more plentiful, and they turn off the source of the capsaic genes, they shut them down, you're off and running with a defective cell. And isn't that what we call cancer? So that's a very simplified, very, very simplified way of looking at it. At this point is where the cell has to decide whether I'm going to die, let's assume the capsaic system is still involved, or I'm going to go on living. I'm going to see if I can be repaired. And as if it gets to the point down here where the damage is irreparable, it then slips into senescence and it deepens on and goes to death. It's going to go that way, period. On this side, this is reactive oxygen species. The DMMT1 is the enzyme that methylates. And methylation you can think of as lockdown. And the enzyme that does, and mobile genetic elements are constantly trying to move, and whenever the cell replicates, if it does, through mitosis, the mobile genetic elements get to jump, and that's when they jump. Because most of the time, the vast majority of mobile genetic elements are under lockdown, except for when the cell has to divide, and that's when they move. And this enzyme is very busy at that point in time trying to lock them back down again. And as you get into a cell that's getting older and older, this enzyme becomes defective, isn't replaced, and so now you don't, the warden fades away. The warden isn't there to get the inmates and put them back in the cells. And then you get down here, DNA methylation decreases, that's the lockdown on the mobile genetic elements. And at the end, you have retrotransposon activation. It's unabated, and the cell dies. Okay. Showing the scientific evidence that there are two operating systems in our body, particularly our mind. One is coded for by mobile genetic elements, the other by God. We have been empowered by God to choose which one we will utilize. Exclusive use of one system will lead to atrophy of the opposed system. Okay, this is my hypothesis. This is my paradigm. Can I go out and prove this to you? No. There's not enough scientific experiments I could come up with that would nail this all down. And even if we were capable of coming up with the experiments, the ethics would get in our way. So. This is an hypothesis, and I'm going to show you why I say that. We talked about ALT1s earlier, retrotransposition in human neuronal progenitor cells. Here we demonstrate that the neuronal progenitor cells isolated from human fetal brain and derived from human embryonic stem cells support the retrotransposition of engineered human L1s in vitro. What are they saying here? Well, they went out and they got some L1s and they mapped them. And they made them in the laboratory. They went ahead and they read what they had mapped and they said, let's get each one of the elements and build our own L1. They build their own L1 and they put it into human neural progenitor cells that they had isolated, and they went right to the right spot and settled in to do their job. It says, furthermore, we developed a quantitative multiplex polymerase chain reaction, PCR, for those of you in genetics, that detected an increase in the copy number of endogenous L1s in the hippocampus and in several regions of the human brain, adult human brains. When compared to the copy number of endogenous L1s in the heart or liver, genomic DNAs from the same donor. What they're saying here is they wanted to look and see how active the L1s were in the human progenitor cells versus a pair of cells from another organ to see where there would be, were they going to be equally active in both? And the answer is no, they're not. They're very active in the neural progenitor cells and they have almost no action at all. They're not transcribed, or they just sit there in the other organs. At least half of the human genome consists of mobile elements. We know it's at least, we're going to be conservative and say 66, because this paper antedates the newer information. Such as lines, some of which can jump around the genome. These elements have been crucial in genome evolution, but they may also contribute to human diversity. And Mutori demonstrated that a human L1 is active in both cultured rat neural progenitor cells and the neural progenitor cells of a transgenic mouse. Transgenic just means a mouse whose genome has had new genetic material brought in. That's all it means. Remarkably, de novo L1 insertions in cultured neural progenitor cells sometimes alter the expression of neuronal genes, thereby affecting neural progenitor cells' differentiation, the process by which the cells mature into specialized cells. Okay, a big mouthful. What are they saying here? These L1s go into these neural progenitor cells and they infect the cells. And when the brain calls and says, I need some more neurons, they call for this neural progenitor cell to come down, but the neural progenitor cell has already been programmed to develop in a specific way. This programming makes that neural cell, it's going to now act in a specific way that it would not have acted had not the L1s set in there. We don't know, it can vary, we don't know exactly in every neural cell what it does, but we know that the activity of that neuron is forever changed by those line-1s, and they're either going to do something, an activity they wouldn't have done before, or they're not going to do an activity that they were programmed originally to do. We don't know which. It can be both, and it's not and or, it can be both. Jumping genes, which make DNA copies of themselves through an RNA middleman, provide a stochastic process for generating brain diversity among humans. The effect of their random insertions, however, is a bit of a gamble. That's stochastic, means you're throwing the dice. You're going to see what happens. And it says, the authors show that normally quiescent jumping genes can be activated in neural progenitor cells. Each hop generates genetic diversity in the nervous system that may or may not affect the function or health of the patient, of the recipient. This is an excellent, this was the same paper, well, it's Nature, August of 2009. What they looked at is some monozygotic twins. And I know someone's going to ask me at the end, where did they get the neurotissue to do this? And I have scoured that paper and I can't find it. I have my suspicions, but let's just take it for what they're going to say here. Monozygotic twins, what they've done is they've done biopsies of neural tissue. And what they find is when you have a monozygotic twin formed, both of the genomes and both of the monozygotic twins are very, very closely aligned, 99%+. And the take-home message is as those twins, and they've looked at live monozygotic twins, they've actually done find ways to not necessarily get brain biopsies, but following other cells in the body, they find that the genome diverges. By the time you're 60, it's hard to determine that they were really monozygotic twins. And the reason why this divergence occurs is because of mobile genetic elements, because the mobile genetic elements act different in each individual. They are a, as the word stochastic, they are a, they provide an element of change which is unpredictable. And that's why, and there's been a lot of monozygotic twin studies, as the twins get older, they lose that ability to, some people say they can communicate with each other when they're one or two, non-verbally, or three, and everything. All that stuff disappears as they get older. Whether it's in fact true or not, I'm just throwing it out as one of the things they look at. We could debate whether that's a real entity or not, and I don't want to do that today. I just want to discuss the general principle. As these monozygotic twins get older, they become different people. And the reason that occurs is due to the mobile genetic elements. Now, if I'm correct in my hypothesis that this is the way the enemy came in and set up the problem, I just want to throw out something very interesting, which we talk about in lectures 12 and 13, 11, 12, and 13, very much more detail, is that if God's going to correct this problem, that means He has got to develop a plan of salvation for each individual. There's not a one-size-fits-all. Each one of these infestations is different. And when you look at the fact of all of the different enzymes, and there's 3.2 billion base pairs in our genome, and you realize the complexity of the situation and all of the combinations and permutations, it becomes mind-boggling. L1 retrotransposition in human neuronal progenitor cells. The main thing for this is that, look at the activity. All of these have to do with CNS type parts of the CNS. Look at heart and liver. See how much the lines activity you can pick up there. It's easily one-fourth, if that. Once the MGEs get into the system, they are programmed to multiply and spread throughout the genome, and that they do. And that's why you end up dying, because eventually you have to undergo mitosis, and during the mitosis project, these guys move around and multiply, and as they take more ground, pretty soon they begin to get the upper hand, and then you saw through senescence, they take over. So it's inevitable. We're going to die. I know that's probably not news to you, but this is why. What does the Bible say? You did run well and did hinder you that you should not obey the truth. And who did hinder you that you should not obey the truth? This persuasion comes not of him that calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. Selfish genetic elements, these are their words, not mine. Genetic conflict and evolutionary innovation. All this is saying is that the cells are constantly fighting off the selfish genetic elements, which are the mobile genetic elements. And this author points out that that's what helped us get evolution and evolve, possibly. He can't tell you how, but he's saying maybe that's how it happened. Okay, I promised you selfish behavior, so I'm going to take a little extra time on this one, because the list I showed you of the eight, I would wager that if I had people voting in the audience, this would be the number one where they'd say, show me. This was put out in 2009 from Israel. They have a number of papers, by the way, if you want to look up these authors. They do a number of, they published a number of findings, all clustered around this. The paper prior to this looked at the vasopressin receptor. Vasopressin receptor is in the male system, is what causes empathy and ability to be able to put yourself in someone else's shoes. And in females, they feel the oxytocin system is higher. You know, when a woman delivers a baby, what does she do? She has a bunch of oxytocin, has to go out to get that baby, to the uterus to contract, and that process changes immensely. Immense changes go on in her amygdala and other areas of her brain, and that's when they're flooding her brain at the time of delivery, and that's they feel very confident, and it's been shown in animals what causes the bonding between a mother and a child. So this is the systems we're talking about. So in this group, they decided, well, we're going to look at, see if oxytocin also affects males, and that's what their idea. So what they did is they took 100, roughly 100 males and 100 females, and they brought them in, and they said, we're going to do the dictator game. And he said, I'll explain to you what the dictator game is. You're going to be put in this office. There's a computer in this office, and it's linked to another computer elsewhere in the building. You don't know where it is. The person that's in that room, you do not know. You don't, you've never met them. You will never meet them because they are going to go out through a different passageway, and they are going to be, they are going to, once they exit this experiment, they are going to go in a manner which, in a way which you cannot, you, there would be no way for you to determine that they had been matched up with you in this process. So complete anonymity was provided to them. And what they did is they sat the person down, they put $100 bills next to him, and they said, now you're the dictator. You won. You're the dictator. There's $100 here. You can keep as much of this money as you want. And the other person has to go with it. All you have to do is get on this computer, which is directly connected to the other, your other co, the other, your co-twin, if you will, your the person you've been matched with, and you just have to type to them, I am giving you $20, which means you're keeping 80. And that's all you have to do. You pick up, we will take $20 of the $1 bills, and we will give you the 80, and you can leave, and we're done. But before they did this, they took a buccal smear from everyone that walked in the room. Now, there was no other experimental victim in another room. This was all fabricated. So the whole experiment was looking to see how much, what they determined altruistic behavior. Altruistic would be if you gave $51 or more to the unknown recipient in another room. Selfish behavior was if you kept $51 or more dollars, then you were, it was called selfish or self-promoting behavior. So that's how they divided it up. And there was a number of people that did 50-50, about 16%. So we throw those out, now we look at the rest. Well, what they found was they, in this paper, they looked at 15 SNPs, which are single nucleotide polymorphisms, which another word of saying one base mutation. And they looked at those, and what they found out was on the buccal mucosa, when they limited it down to three, because there's 15 generally in the population mutations in the oxytocin receptor, when they were able to find that three of those receptors, they could have very high predictability whether the person was going to act altruistic or selfish. On one of them, it was 0.001 as far as the probability of their being able to predict was at the 0.001 level. And what they found was that if the person had that mutation at that spot, that SNP, that the in reality, if you look at the actual numbers, it's about 78 or 80% of them acted in a selfish behavior. And if you didn't have any of those, if you had none of those three mutations, it about flipped. You were 66 or 70 or somewhere in that percent that you would act altruistically. Now, the important thing to remember here is that the genes did not dictate. In other words, it wasn't 100%. You had those three SNPs, you were going to be selfish, period. Or if you didn't have those, that you were definitely going to be altruistic. The individual still had the ability to override this predisposition. So they then went ahead and they said, well, men are a bunch of dirtbags anyway. They're conflicting the data because they were trying to show that there was a difference between men and women, and they were going to, you know, vasopressin versus oxytocin. So they did it again with 100 women. They said, we're going to start from scratch, bring another 100 women in, and the results were the same. There are other papers attached to this one. If you want to pull this one up and look at it, they talk about the social value orientation task. That was one that didn't use money, and they were trying to show that the same thing occurred, and it did. It used points, but the idea was much the same. And you can see that they, and their other papers, have made, I think, not proof, but a very good supporting evidence that the coding on specific areas of protein coding areas of our working in our CNS definitely affect, have a predisposition to affect our behavior. And I can't go into this. I'm running short on time. It's just that the argument that these guys are making in this paper is that we put killers to death, and they're making an argument that many of them have a lack of a negative feedback loop in parts of the amygdala where you experience anger, and that instead of it shutting down the dopamine that is being released in that process, there is no negative feedback loop to tape it down, and the dopamine release in that area increases in the rage until they get to the place where they become so filled with anger that they do things that are such as homicide. And they have a family over somewhere in Estonia where they were looking at with this. So anyway, just something we don't have time. Two systems in conflict. For in him we live and move and have our being, and also certain of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. The important point I want to make here is that God is the supporting power, and he is the providing the multiple background tasks that have to be done every day so that we can even make a choice, so that we can either spit in his face or we can become sons and daughters of Christ. But without God supporting this whole process, the game would be over. And part of the reason why that is we would have been dead long ago from the mobile genetic elements. We wouldn't even get this far. So the graciousness of the Creator to be able to sustain human beings so that they can, if they choose, utilizing, this is my the paradigm that's being presented here, using the genetic information that has been put in by the other side, can use that to go against God and kill him. He will still support them in that process in this earthly sojourn right now. Scientists are discovering that, to a surprising degree, we contain genetic multitudes. Not long ago, researchers had thought it was rare for the cell in a single healthy person to differ genetically in a significant way. But scientists are finding that it's quite common for an individual to have multiple genomes. That's right, multiple genomes. There's not just one that defines you. Well, there's one which is the majority. And if you want to say that it defines you, yes, in general terms it does. But we are all made up of multiple genomes. And that some people, for example, have a group of cells with mutations that are not found in the rest of the body. Some have genomes that come from other people. Scientists are finding links from multiple genomes to certain rare diseases, now that they're beginning to investigate genetic variations to shed light on more complex disorders. Science changing view is also raising questions about how forensic scientists should use DNA evidence to identify people. It's also posing challenges for genetic counselors, who can't assume that the genetic information from one cell can tell them about the DNA throughout a person's body. And this is coming up more and more. In fact, I just was reading this 2 weeks ago that the guys making the ticket, the kits for you, you send in a buccal mucosa, and they print out all your potential. Do you have BRCA1? Do you have BRCA2? And they'll do all these things for you. First of all, some of them are notoriously inaccurate, but then they also pointed out that actually that may be because the sample they got is one of the genomes which is not the dominant one. Last year, for example, forensic scientists at Washington State Patrol Crime Laboratory Division described how a saliva sample and a sperm sample from the same suspect in a sexual assault case didn't match. What they found was this woman was raped, unfortunately, and she pointed out who the criminal, the bad guy was. And so they took him in and took a buccal mucosa smear, and they tried to match up from the fluid taken from the woman to match up to see if they would get a match with his buccal mucosa, and it didn't match at all. And the woman said, I'm telling you, that's the guy. I'm telling you, that's the guy. So then they went, someone thought, hey, we'll take some seminal fluid from the alleged rapist, and let's compare it, and it matched up perfectly. So what the paper went on to say is, this whole idea of DNA in past criminal cases is now going to, defense attorneys are now going to have a field day, making the courts readdress and say, no, that wasn't my client. That was, your DNA is not specific. Your test is not specific enough anymore. It could be, there's many other confounding variables. The retrotransposons is a major source of epigenetic variations in the mammalian genome. Just the last sentence here. Overall, these data confirm the presence of a number of new retrotransposon-derived epialleles with the suggestion of the presence of more, and further identify retrotransposons as a major source of genetic variations in the mammalian genome. And this I want to spend a little bit of time on. It's very interesting. Gerald Crabtree is a professor of pathology and developmental biology at Stanford. And he wrote a very interesting paper in Trends in Genetics in January of 2013, a year ago. And in this, what he said is that he believes that humans have not been on the ascent, that actually, as far as mental function and intellectual functioning, that we have been on a descent, which is very countercurrent toward the evolutionary approach that we're getting better and environment is selecting out much better organisms. Anyway, he says, the basis for my wager comes from, let me go back. I would also make this wager for the ancient inhabitants of Africa, Asia, India, or Americas of perhaps 2,000 to 6,000 years ago. I really got to read the beginning of this. I would wager that if an average citizen from Athens of 1,000 BC were to appear suddenly among us, he or she would be among the brightest and most intellectually alive of our colleagues and companions, with a good memory, a broad range of ideas, and clear-sighted view of important issues. Furthermore, I would guess that he or she would be among the most emotionally stable of our friends and colleagues, and I would also make this wager for the ancient inhabitants of Africa, Asia, India, or the Americans of perhaps 2,000 to 6,000 years ago. The basis for my wager comes from new developments in genetics, anthropology, and neurobiology that make a clear prediction that our intellectual and emotional abilities are genetically surprisingly fragile. And another way of putting it is, in this paper he says, we are losing ground on all fronts. And as his evidence, he points out the Lyme-1s and the neuroprogenitor cells, which we have briefly talked about earlier this morning, that they have come in there and they have taken the source of our intellectual capabilities, which are in those progenitor cells in the embryonic state, and they have messed with them in a way to make them far less likely to produce brains which are able to handle difficult problems. I'm not going to read this. This is telling us more of the same thing. He says here, the Lyme-1 insertions occur in neural stem cells and lead to clones of neurons with specific insertion sites. Each neuron is estimated to sustain about 80 L1 insertions, indicating that the gene expression is dysregulated in most neurons. Dysregulated. Taken together, the large number of genes required for intellectual and emotional function and the unique susceptibility of these genes to loss of heterozygosity lead me to conclude that we as a species are surprisingly intellectually fragile and perhaps reached a peak 2,000 to 6,000 years ago, but if we are losing our intellectual abilities, how did we acquire them in the first place? And then he goes on to go into a different topic. I'm not going to talk about this. There is an unending war in the cell. MGs attempt to multiply and spread. The cells counter by quarantine or mutating the MGEs. And that's what this paper is talking about, a matter of life and death, how microsatellites, that's another word from mobile genetic elements, in emerge in and vanish from the human genome. It's an ongoing battle. It's just an ongoing battle that we're slowly losing until we age and die. Large-scale discovery of insertion hotspots and preferential integration sites in human of transposed elements. Okay, here's where my hypothesis comes in. Here's where I'm going to suggest something to you, and that is this. They have known very well that when you engage in certain intellectual processes such as thoughts and things of that nature, the electrical activity goes down what's called engrams. Usually there's an anchor cell. They're usually 8 neurons long. Sometimes they are more than that. Sometimes there's just 1 or 2 neurons. But the point is, when those neurons are used, that part of the cell, which is coding for that special memory, is open. It's an open reading frame. And here is my hypothesis that I'm going to put to you. If you are opening the frame at that point, you're opening it all along that segment. And if there is a mobile genetic element which has been planted there and has changed that neuroprogenitor cell, which now has become a neuron, to function in a certain way, it can receive and will receive more mobile genetic elements in. And this paper describes how the mobile genetic elements are able to find other embedded mobile genetic elements when they're jumping, and they come in and they increase in numbers. And increasing in numbers makes them more effective in controlling what that nerve cell is going to do. Using your mind to think thoughts which have been, and we're going to get to circuits in a minute, that have been engineered by, that are primarily under control of mobile genetic elements, will increase the mobile genetic elements and make those circuits stronger and harder to eradicate. And if you read this paper, it will tell you biologically at least how that can happen. And this isn't not just some pie in the sky, I'm coming up with an idea. It happens. I just can't say it happens in the way I just told you. But it happens every day, all the time, in our brains, exactly that, this exact thing occurs. And finally, we performed a global assessment to determine the extent to which young transposable elements tend to nest within older transposable elements and identified a 4-fold higher tendency of transposable elements to insert into existing TEs than to insert within non-transposable element intergenic regions. Our analysis demonstrates that TEs are highly biased to insert within certain TEs in specific orientations and within specific targeted transposable elements. The TE nesting events also reveal how characteristics of the molecular mechanisms underlying transposition. Don't have time to talk about this because I've been too verbose, but stress does all kinds of things. It actually changes the methylation in the brain, changes the epigenetic landscape, and what it does is and it's been really shown in post-traumatic stress syndrome, it allows mobile genetic elements, which about 30% of the population have in this part area in the amygdala, to run, to be transcribed and to produce controlling elements, which go out and cause, for instance, neurons in the anxiety area to start firing constantly. There's no negative feedback. And this is a great paper to go look at that. I'm not going to read this. Retrotransposition of gene transcripts leads to structural variations in mammalian genomes. Okay, I got to talk about this for a moment because this is big. And I don't think, I would be surprised if anyone in this audience knew this. Aneuploid neurons, now aneuploid means that if you're euploid, you have 46 chromosomes in this cell, and they're intact. Now, they may have different alleles, they may have, but the size of the genetic information is correct. It's 3.2 billion base pairs. And you have intact chromosomes. If you're aneuploid, that means that you don't have that. So what happens is instead of having 46, you may have 45 7/8. Or you may have 46 and 1/5. An example of this would be if you've heard of trisomy 21. Trisomy 21, you don't actually have three 21 chromosomes. You have two 21 chromosomes and additions to one of them, or even a little fragment that sits out there. And the more of the third 21 chromosome you have, the more mental impairment of the recipient. Create a shot, which is minus 5P, which you have the short arm of the fifth chromosome is gone in one of the two pairs. Trisomy 18, same thing. And the more that you have either the inclusion of part of another chromosome, that a sister chromosome that shouldn't be there, or that you the chromosome there gave up part of its information to the other part of the in the mitosis. Either way, it's a problem. It is a problem. And it says the existence of aneuploid cells within the mammalian brain has suggested the influence of genetic mosaicism on normal neuronal circuitry. Coincidentally, labeling for immediate early gene expression indicated that these aneuploid neurons were functionally active. That's important. The scientists said, well, there's so many of these aneuploid neurons, they must not work. This is too much of a change to the information system, that they're probably just space-occupying lesions up there. They're not doing anything. And what this paper came out and says, oh no, they're working. The vast majority of them are working, but they're not working well. So then we have to decide, well, and how many of them are involved? 64%. It's the number they came up with of your brain and my brain have neurons which are aneuploid. Now, we don't know, science can't tell us exactly what those aneuploid cells do, but if they do anything, it's not good. We have defective machinery. Big time. Thus, a network composed of intermixed euploid and aneuploid neurons might produce unique signaling properties distinct from a network composed purely of euploid cells. It is also notable. Did you notice that? Network, because I'm going to go into networks right now, right? Next couple of slides. It changes the way that network's going to function. It is also notable that the gene expression mapping strategies from different brain regions detect an average or pooled representation of expressed genes within a brain region, likely masking heterogeneity of gene expression produced by the mosaicism of intermixed aneuploid and euploid cells. What they're saying is the way we look at brains now is not specific enough. We can't get down to see exactly what these uniploid, aneuploid cells are doing. This paper talks about circuits, and all I'm going to tell you is circuits are big, they're going to get bigger, and these circuits are the way that we generate, the brain generates everything it does. It's going to do it through different circuits. It says the greatest consequence of controlling neuronal activity with finer precision has been the characterization of individual neural circuits within anatomical brain regions as defined functional units. Here is a a special form of fMRI. We can talk about that later. It has to do with the way water diffuses. It's called a diffusion MRI, the way the water diffuses across the different neurons. They're able to actually follow the electrical current. And if it's green, it's posterior-anterior. If it's red, it's right-left. And if it's purple, it's the opposite of that. So if it's right, left, right. And then all the other different colors are a combination of it going in more than one direction. I put that up here just to show you the circuits they've been able to find so far. And you can see how these, they all interplay with each other. So if you had 64% of those circuits malfunctioning, that'd be a pretty big deal. But it's not actually that simple, because multiple neurons can be part of multiple circuits. So the chances of you getting a circuit without an aneuploid cell is probably small. Given our stated assumption that the adversary is entirely responsible for the existence of mobile genetic elements, then there must be just two entities that are capable of programming our information, God and the adversary. But the one doubting, if he eats, he has been condemned because it is not of faith, and all that is not of faith is sin. What Paul is saying here is there's only two, and I'm going to use my words now, not Paul's, this is coming from me, there's two circuits set up in your brain, two types of circuits. That's it. There's not a third where you are. In other words, this is under the devil's, he's responsible for engineering, encoding it, and God has been responsible for this when the devil's hijacked, taken them from God's area and brought them into his. And then there's some in the middle where you and I sit. It's not there. It's one or the other. You've got two systems, period. And some people will say, and I put this in here purposely, well, how do you know mobile genetic elements are really from another source? How do you really know that they're maybe just an adaptation of the cell eons ago? Well, here's the final argument, which I don't think there's an answer for, and that is this. How do cells distinguish normal genes from transposons? Although much has been learned about RNA related RNA silencing pathways, RNAi, that's inhibition, silencing pathways responsible for genome defense, this fundamental question remains. The literature points to several classes of mechanisms. In some cases, double-stranded RNA structures produced by transposon inverted repeats or antisense integration trigger endogenous small interfering RNAs biogenesis. In other instances, DNA features associated with transposons, such as their unusual copy number and chromosome arrangement and or chromatin environment, licensing RNA silencing. Finally, recent studies have identified improper transcript processing events such as stalled pre-mRNA splicing. Thus, the suboptimal gene expression properties of selfish elements can enable their identification by RNA silencing pathways. If you'll notice, that's from January of 2014, so it's rather recent. But it goes on. There's two other papers I purposely did not put in because I would get lost in them, so I'm just going to tell you real quickly. They are looking at quantum spin on microRNAs as being the ability for the microRNA to know exactly which part of the DNA it's going to interact with. They've found six different quantum spins on six different microRNAs, and they have showing evidence suggestive that that's how the microRNAs are able to go and pick out unerringly whether they're going to, microRNAs either suppress mobile genetic elements or they empower them. There's no in between. And so they're coming up with the idea that maybe the way that the cell can tell the difference is the microRNAs and all of the mobile genetic elements, the products of them, have a different spin to them, quantum spin, and that's how they're able to tell the difference. And another one is has the DNA is able to take an electrical current and has an electrical current going through it all the time. That's how it can find if there's a break, the electrical current alerts the cell's own defense mechanisms, the repair mechanisms that come in and repair the DNA when there's a split. There's a change when you make DNA in vitro and then you compare it to, if you make it exactly the same as DNA in a cell, they carry current differently. So if we make it, it carries current differently than if it was originally made in the cell. And the argument there is the original equipment, therefore, would have a different capability of carrying electrical activity. For as he thinketh within himself, so is he. Eat and drink, says he to thee, but his heart is not with thee. So as we think, our neural circuitry defines who we are. That's where we live. That makes me, me, and you, you. The thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord, but the words of the pure are pleasant. For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands defiles not a man. And if we had more time, I would try to make the argument that engaging in that type of thought is increasing the mobile genetic element contents in those circuits, making the circuits much stronger, and as it gets stronger, the probability of you acting on them becomes higher and higher, depending on your circumstances, and you see that's how you would make that work. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destructions are in their path. For I delight in the law of the Lord after the inner man, but I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. What Paul's saying is, he agrees there's two systems. They're going on and all the time. They're fighting for supremacy. For you desire not sacrifice, else I would give it. You delight not in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. Heart, of course, you might as well substitute mind here, because then they thought all the emotions and things of that nature were in the heart back at the time that was written. And what does he want us to do? He wants us to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Now you can see why we're dealing at a thought level and why it's so important, because you're actually in the brain. How you use those neurons will actually change at least the epigenetic terrain of those neurons. And by changing the epigenetic, you can actually change the genetic by opening the door for more mobile genetic elements to enter. For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is peace and life. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God. If it's a mobile genetic element controlled circuit, Paul is defining this for us here. He's saying it's going to produce behavior or thoughts or whatever. Whatever it produces is going to be at war with what God wants. And you can't have both. You can't have part of a circuit that's under that original equipment and part that's under MGE control. They don't mix. And Paul says, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. So the war going on, I showed you earlier in Matthew 15, Christ makes it very clear, the real war going on is in your mind and what you think. And remember what he said in Matthew 5:48, if you look at a woman and you lust at her, you've committed adultery with her. We talk about that later in the I think it's lecture 6 or 7, where we go into that from a genetic point of view. It's fascinating. Blessed are the pure heart, they will see God. And why is another reason why this is, it's not just the fact that if you're using, and this is my hypothesis, you're using circuitry, which are mobile genetically element influenced, or highly influenced, or even controlled, that you're strengthening those circuits. There's another flip side to this, and that is microglia. Microglia are resident brain cells that sense pathologic tissue alterations. Experimental studies support the idea that microglia have a role in the maintenance of synaptic integrity. Analogous to electricians, they are capable of removing defunct axon terminals, thereby helping neuronal connections to stay intact. Microglia in healthy CNS tissue do not qualify as macrophages, and their specific functions are beginning to be explored. What this paper goes on to say is this: if you don't use a circuit, your mind, your microglia eat up the connections, the dendrite to axon connections, because it's a weight on your electrical activity in your brain. So if you're not using circuits, they disappear, and we all know that. I pick up some stuff I knew many years ago in medical school, and I have to look at it again. I remember that it was there, but the circuits that had originally had all the information were hard to find. They're gone. Didn't use them. The same goes for us. If we are thinking, that's why Paul says, think on these things. If you're thinking on those things, those circuits are going to become more prominent. Whereas if you're using the other mobile genetic influenced or controlled circuitry, they're going to be more prominent. And the microglia go along and take away circuits that were there that aren't being used. Now, mercifully, we're at one slide away, two slides from being done. So I want you to watch this very carefully, because this is an excellent demonstration of what I believe the devil did, only it's a very crude approximation. It's not nearly as sophisticated as what he did. And in this short clip, they're going to show you a laser that is taken in via these conducting tubes into this mouse's brain. And you can substitute that to something in our environment. And then you have a good idea of what the devil did, because otherwise, from my paradigm, they did exactly what the devil did for us, starting at the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So let's see if I can get this to run.
Today we can manipulate human brains by tampering with the senses, bathing the brain in chemicals, or by playing psychological mind games. But all these methods influence the brain from the outside in. A true mind hack, one that opens us up for reprogramming of any kind, may require something more audacious. Reaching inside a living brain and flicking a switch. MIT engineer, physicist, and neuroscientist Ed Boyden has spent his career figuring out how complex machines work. He's now working on the most complex machine of all, the human brain.
A cubic millimeter of brain tissue has 100,000 cells, and there are a billion connections between them. These cells compute using electricity, and if all these little electrical computers could be recorded, perturbed, controlled, and analyzed, then maybe we could understand how the brain computed in the same way that computers are engineered to do all the things that they do in our phones and on the internet and so on. So if you have a complex system, whether it's a computer or a city or the economy or a brain, one of the ways that you can figure out what's going on is to actually put little inputs into the system and see what happens.
It's easy to test the components on a computer circuit board, but brain cells are a little trickier. So Ed set out to find a natural switch that can turn individual neurons on or off. And he found one, swimming around in a puddle of pond water.
This kind of algae actually has this light sensor. It sits in a little eye spot in the back of the algae. And basically, these are little light-activated proteins known as opsins that sit in the membranes of cells and serve as photosynthetic or photosensory protein. And this is a molecule that converts light into a very specific change in electrical potential, the exact same kind that occurs in neurons when they're active.
Ed and his colleagues extracted from the algae the genetic code that produces these light-sensitive opsins. They then inserted this gene into a virus that could splice itself into the DNA of living brain cells.
The neurons in the brain will manufacture the protein, because now the genome has been incorporated into the nucleus of those cells, and then express those proteins all over the membranes or boundaries of those cells.
Ed's virus instructs any infected neurons to build a light-sensitive on-off switch. With these switches, any brain circuit, from our senses to our emotional state and memories, could be controlled with this.
So this is a laser that we developed here, which will then split that laser light out into an array of optical fibers that we can enter information into the brain into many different points that are distributed in a three-dimensional pattern. The brain doesn't feel pain, so we can implant little probes into the brain, deliver light out the end of these probes, and then we'll turn on or off parts of the brain just by pulsing this laser, turning the laser on and off very rapidly.
Ed and his colleagues first put their technology to trial with animal subjects. Ed wired his light-sensitive switches into a mouse's pleasure-reward brain circuits.
We put in an optical fiber into the brain such that it could deliver light to those cells. Then we programmed a computer such that whenever a mouse poked its nose into a little sensor, it would get a pulse of light.
Each pulse of blue light activates the same pleasure reward circuits that turn on when the rodent eats a piece of food or finds a mate. The mouse keeps poking its head into the hole, convinced that this simple action is the source of the reward.
And so what we found was that mice would actually work for light. They would poke their nose into the little sensor, get a pulse of light, say, hey, you know, that was interesting, and then do it over and over again, basically doing tasks in order to get a pulse of light. And so what this tells us is that very brief activation of this set of cells with a pulse of light is enough to reinforce whatever the animal was doing just before.
Ed has hacked the mind of a mouse and changed its behavior. And he believes it won't be long before we are ready to use the technique on the human brain.
Arguably, humans have been, you know, hacking the brain for a very long time. You know, beer, coffee. Those are examples of neurotechnologies that their main role is to change what the brain does. Drugs, pharmaceuticals have been very, very impactful in treating brain disorders. But if you think about the brain as a circuit, then a drug that goes throughout the entire brain is going to affect circuits that you want to leave intact as well as circuits that you want to fix. And so that's where our technologies come into play. We really can make a subset of those cells activatable or silenceable with our tools.
Ed's technology could be a cure for the nearly 1 billion people who suffer from mental illness by turning off only unhealthy cells. It would be a revolution in psychiatric medicine. And one day, it could give us all complete control of the workings of our brains. The rewards for hacking into our brains could be momentous. Mental diseases could be eliminated. We could unlock the highest levels of talent. And we could truly understand what another person feels. But there is a dark side to this technology. We could be creating a future where no one is sure of who they are. No secrets could ever be safe. And where we might all lose our minds to brain hackers.
So in making the paradigm, iniquity, when you see iniquity in the Bible, just for the basis of this argument, put in the word transposable elements or mobile genetic elements. Just try it when you read your Bible. And that sin is the unsanctioned changing of God's information system by either deleting or by either deletion or addition to the code, which, if not controlled, will lead to addiction. And then I'm go on to say that sin is, in all of its forms, when it's mature, is an addiction. Any one that you want to take. So with that, here it says, whoever commits sin transgresses also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. Law is the addition or subtraction, unsanctioned addition or subtraction from the genome. Then when lust is conceived, it brings forth sin. So that's the circuitry. You're using the circuitry. Sin is what we actually, here we look at it, you and I talk about it as behavior, but I would argue that it's more addition or more subtraction from the original code. And when it brings forth death, and we saw today how death can occur, the first death. And so here it says that the result of all this is who are taken captive, him being the devil, at his will. In other words, he's got the equipment in place. He doesn't have to exercise it at all times. He can wait till a specific time before he activates it. In this, you saw in the animated portion, where the light caused it to occur. But you could have those cells set up in such a way that different stimuli would do it as well. And the other thing, which we talk about later in the lectures, is that the G-coupled protein system, of which this was one, opsins were one of the first G-coupled proteins that were found, either is 90% plus under the control of mobile genetic elements, or some authors are saying it was brought into the system, that the G-coupled proteins were actually the product of mobile genetic elements. So if you own the G-coupled protein system, you own everything, because there's no cells that aren't affected by it. Okay, mercifully, I am done. And so if some of you aren't in a stupor state and have a question, I'll be glad to take it. Yes?
I really enjoyed this thoughtful presentation. It's very thorough. And one thing that struck me is that this kind of fits, it's a theological equivalent of sanctification, as all the bad circuits kind of drop off into disuse, atrophy, and you act only on the new epigenetic information, maybe with help of the Holy Spirit and so forth.
Yes. Can you hear me? Is this mic on or? Okay.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic, a lot of interesting stuff. It seems, though, that it may only be part of the picture, because what I'm hearing is our ability to choose is purely physicalism. That is, it's not touching upon the recognition that we have a body-soul, mind-soul dualism that has to have some independence if we're going to truly have free will. And so you're touching upon the physical part, but I don't see the connection here with the part of that God gave us. In Ecclesiastes, he talks about our bodies return to the ground, and then our soul goes back to God who gave it to us. And so I don't see the connection in this discussion between this substance dualism that really recognizes that there is a difference between the two.
Well, a number of things. First of all, I don't see the dualism, and other further lectures will. I'm going to argue in further lectures, or at least propose, not argue because I'm proposing, that really the, let me back up. When we look at what the DNA does, the actual code, they're now, most scientists are now saying that is a basement structure to where the real activity is. It's necessary for it to be there. If you have parts of it that are gone or parts of it that are changed, it's going to change the building that's going to be built, and it may change it in very significant ways or insignificant ways depending upon how big of a structural change it has. But that's not where the action is. That's not where thinking is. It's providing the hardware. It's building the hardware where, and I'm going to use software, and this is not the most perfect analogy, where the software is going to work. And let's use the thinking and free will part as the software. I know you can make arguments why this is not a good analogy, but let's just, for argument's sake, let's go for it. At the end of the day, there's a lot of work being done now on free will, dealing with the fact that it appears that biological entities, I'll use the word brains, they use entities, are what is capable to perform, you know, about coherence, decoherence. Brains are a decohering machine. And I don't want to go into this because the weeds are real deep. And I don't want to get out there in those deep weeds. I'm not prepared to do it right now. But I'm going to argue, not argue, but I'm going to counter with you and say, look, I think it's all in this package. I think that what our brains do is that we don't have nearly the concept of how they work, where the real thinking goes. We are looking at some basic underlying structural work, and we're making inferences from it. Though structural work is required for the higher levels of information processing that are going to occur, but that those levels we haven't touched on yet. We don't know where they are. We know if we change the base structural elements, it will have an effect on the higher level functions, but we don't know what those functions are. And all we know is that, for instance, on psychosis, you can definitely set up very bad circuitry and you're going to get aberrant thoughts and non-coordinated thoughts.
Yeah, but you're still staying in the realm of physicalism. I mean, it's all our physical processes in our mind or in our body. To truly have libertarian free will, we have to be able to have a causal sequence that starts outside of our body. If it always just passes through our body, then our ability to choose is determined by our environment, by our chemical structure in our brain, by these free agents that are moving around. That's pure physicalism. And as a result, our choice is determined not freely, but determined by our environment and our experience and our health state and all that kind of stuff. And so you can't. I don't see how you can really talk about God's action in us making free will choices unless you recognize there's some dualism there that allows that process.
Okay, what I think you're telling me is that I'm preaching a deterministic sermon here. And I would say to you, and before I would counter with, there's some great articles, and have you heard of Stuart Kaufman? Well, he wrote a book called Reinventing the Divine, and I'm not telling you should read that book in the sense that his argument from beginning to end is, I don't need a God. I don't need a God for everything that I see. All right? But he makes some really fantastic arguments from neuroscience and things of this area where he goes into free will and he says there is free will. It is not determinism. It's not reduction. Reductionary materialist, getting all caught up. It is not a determined situation, and he goes into the quantum levels and where you get decoherence and the ability.
Does it make it probabilistic? Does it make it non-physical?
But probabilistic, if it is physical, no longer is determining. So it takes you out. It takes you out of the determinism.
The causal path still passes through you, not originates in your mind. Okay, you still don't have free will ability to initiate a causal sequence, which is what free will allows us to do. And you're always flowing it, even though it's probabilistic, there's going to be possible different outcomes. It still passes through us, not originates.
Well, I will put it, this is the way it's described. Maybe, I don't know if we're talking, using different words, same concept or whatever. What happens is, when you decohere, you have multiple choices, multiple areas to decohere from. No, but that's where he steps in and says that the organisms are capable of, at that point, and he cannot tell you how that occurs, is capable of making a choice in the decoherence process as to which one they're going to decohere.
I think there's something that needs to be said, though. There is a model out there that says you can choose anytime you want to, anytime, and I don't think it's actually a biblical model because he who commits sin is a slave to sin. And if it were not for God deliberately giving us back our free choice that we lost, all of us would, after the first choice, be lost to sin. And that's theological. That's not Bob's model at all, but it does fit. What it says is that once you go the wrong way, you may not have that choice in and of yourself, and it may take a miracle, if you please, to put that choice back into you. And I think that that's what God does, is every once in a while he'll come along, and we don't have, you know, I think the song Once to Every Man and Nation is probably exaggerating too. That it's not only one time ever, but that God comes to us multiple times. But it's not like every moment we have the choice to choose that at least if we're in sin, we don't have that choice. And it takes God's specific re-injection of free choice, if you please, to change that. I think that one of the things you've done is made an excellent argument for the concept of original sin. And original sin leads to the first death, and God has made provision for that. But what it says is that we're actually asking for miracles, and we just don't realize it because we see them often enough that we think, well, this must be the way the human brain works. Whereas, in fact, if we yield to sin, we become captives of sin. And we do have not only environmental but hereditary tendencies towards evil.
I'd just like to say one more thing. I think Dr. Brandstetter is there. Or did you? Were you just holding the mic for fun? Are you? I'm going to just make one quick comment, and then we'll go to this. If you take the choice, for instance, I'm an anesthesiologist, and suppose I bring before you three things for you to choose from, all right? And you make a choice. Then I bring you back the next day, and I say I'm going to give you three things to choose from again. Only this time I inject some ketamine. Your choice now is bizarre. So you had free will the day before, and you don't now, and it's due to a chemical difference between the two states. So the materialistic state affects whatever it is, how you make a decision. It affects it because I can affect your ability to make decisions. Chemical.
Well, that's coercion, and God doesn't. He wants our choice to accept his salvation.
I agree.
Free will choice, and it's not coercion. What you're describing is the insertion of coercion.
But it's materialistic coercion. That's the point. And if materialistic can go in there and can change your choice, then I'm going to argue that materialism is not exempt from this because it obviously makes a difference in your choice here. Why won't it make a difference throughout the argument?
Well, because our actions are materialistic. Okay, so but our mind, we have to understand our mind and how it, and that it can function in this dualistic process if we're going to truly understand the concept of libertarian free will.
So, what do you have to say, Dr. Brandstetter?
I'm not going to resolve this one. But did I miss something that you said at the very beginning today? The origin of these mobile genetic elements that now constitute 66% or so of our genome? What happened, this is my real question, what happened in your paradigm when God cursed the earth and its inhabitants? What difference, if we're going to be really physical, what happened in the human genome then and there?
Well, next week, as fate would have it, I'm going to be discussing, I'm down here re-recording two out of a 13 series that got destroyed when I was at Kettering. And rather than trying to redo it there on systems that were very poor, to say the least, I'm ending up here doing these two recordings to make the finish of the 13th. Next week, I have to do number 5, which says, what happened in the garden? Where I'm going to be discussing this just exactly what you... Can you wait till next week, if you can, to come or see it on the internet?
I'll hold my breath.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, maybe to interject a few biblical things here. One is, as it says, like in the instance of the Pharaoh, God said he hardened his heart. Now, basically, I think most of us understand that once his heart was hardened, he really didn't have much choice. I mean, he was going to go with what he originally was going with. So there is kind of a physical change that God's word speaks of. Another thing is, he says that as we sin, we become blinded. So that makes it more difficult. Obviously, this is saying it makes it more difficult to make the right choices as far as godly, just, and righteous choices or whatnot.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And it also, there's another scripture that says we look through a glass darkly, and I would say, again, that's because of the sin. That
1 Corinthians 13. Yeah.
I think that would be an example of sin binds and blinds. That you get caught up in it. But I was hoping next week, will you also discuss what may have happened to the genome at the flood, because people were living a long time longer before, and then that changed. I was wondering if you'd reflect on that.
Unfortunately, that's not part of the topic, but I do touch it on it. It's not part of the 13 either. It's touched. I've given other lectures there where I go exactly into that. And as you might guess, we're looking at genetics. Pretty heavily. So I believe that there is a that there is a genetic answer supported in the science, which is in no way in conflict with the Bible on that.
Can you give in five sentences kind of a general outline?
The reason I can't is because I've done this in the past, and then people take it out of context, and when you and you've tried to do something in a very quick manner and you make some statements and then it comes back sounding very ludicrous and nothing you would have ever accepted in a moment. So I've learned the hard way. Either you give the whole thing or you don't. I'm very bad at using this. As you all. Oops, definitions. Which one? This one? This is the end of the talk, so I'd have to go back. Oh, this is, I took this out. This is interesting. Can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? Then you may also do good that are accustomed to do evil. The only way the Ethiopian can change his skin or the leopard his spots is to change his genome, period. That's it. There's no other way to do it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
You know, I know your background a little bit, so I know you know a lot of these things. But, you know, when Adam and Eve sinned, God went and looked up to everybody and said that man has become like one of us, knowing good from evil. And then he says that we can't let him go through the tree of life or else he would live forever. Now, we were talking about outside things versus inside things. And it looks like the tree of life is an outside source of something. And it looks like, even though they made the wrong decision, that if they still had access to that tree, they would live forever. So I'm hearing from you that as soon as they sinned, something got injected into their being that started going down.
I say they ingested it.
Well, injected, yeah. Ingested, it's the same thing. And as a consequence, they will die. But the Bible seems to say is that they died because they were separated from the tree of life.
Yeah, I will. This is another whole lecture that I'm in the process of making, and will be given at a later time, maybe in Kettering. I don't know if it'll be given here. But I will venture out on this one because I know where I'm going on it, and I feel comfortable. I'm going to suggest to you, I can't give you all the supporting evidence, but I have more than I have for this stuff. But let's just say, for argument's sake, that there is some need of our information system to be integrated, okay? And that if you have going for long periods of time without integration, you will end up getting multiple systems going. Because I'm not saying that new code is not going to be written in the new earth. I think it will be. I think we will be able to grow and progress, and Ellen White talks about it's an infinite possibilities that are opening before us. You would have to have a correctly addition of code for that to occur. So I'm not saying God does not allow your code to change. It's got to be changed in a cause and effect way. Galatians 6:7, God is not mocked. You will reap exactly what you sow, sort of thing. And that has to do with free will, and that has to do with moral change and ethics and all kinds of other things that flow from that. But that would then necessitate, if you are going to have new code, you're going to have it integrated into the system. Otherwise, you'll start having, for instance, Microsoft and DOS and all these other stuff work. You have to bring these, and what I didn't show you, and I have some wonderful slides on the integration of the systems within not only the nucleus, but within the brain, how they integrate. So the nucleus, circuitry, brain, you build up in level of complexity. So what the thing is this. I'm going to just propose an idea to you. If Adam and Eve had been in the garden and not partaken of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, let's just stipulate that, let's do a mind experiment. And they didn't do it. They stayed true. But at some point in time along the way, Adam and Eve had said, Adam says, you know, I'm tired of this. I don't want to live here anymore. And he says, the one way that we have is that I won't eat of the tree of life anymore. Ellen White makes it very clear. If he had done that, he would have died. So this tree of life is vital for the sustaining of the systems that are going to keep us alive, primarily, and I'm sure it goes throughout the body, but especially in dealing with the brain. I'm going to make that argument. I'm just going to make some statements, and I'm not, obviously I can't back them up. But here's the point. Ellen White says that the tree of life, and I'm paraphrasing this, she says that it is the ultimate antidote to, what was it? The antidote to death. And you cannot die with it being present. And if you also go look, God says that they will eat of the tree and live forever. Ellen White makes a statement that sin will be immortalized, but she doesn't say they're going to live. That it's not because they're living forever. She says it's going to be immortalized. So here's the question I would have to you. Let's go back and play this scenario again. Let's suppose that Adam and Eve do eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and then they go and eat of the tree of life. Now they're going to live forever, right? By the definitions we've been told. Well, would there not be a plan of salvation for them then? Because Ellen White makes it very clear. God says they're going to live forever. Ellen White says they would, in another statement, that they would be forever in the camp of the evil one. So I'm going to suggest to you that eating the tree of life is an integration. It may do multiple things, but one of the things it does is it integrates systems together and makes them permanently part of the organism. And had Adam and Eve eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil and then eaten of the tree of life, they would have been perpetual sinners. And she says in another place where the devil's whole idea was that he wanted them to do exactly that because they would be forever his allies in his rebellion against God. So and why would there be God have a tree like this? Well, we could argue that there's all kinds of systems that have to go on that would need exogenous input of certain as yet unnamed biological entities that would perform this. But there's another reason, I think. And that is, in order to have free will, you have to have free choice. When over in Russia, when they used to have elections, when it was the Soviet Socialist Republic, they would come to a town and they would say, here's the guy who's running for your mayor. And there'd be one name. And then there'd be another slot below it where you could write any other name in that you wanted. And so what they would do, they say, we're a democracy. We have no problem. We hand out these ballots to everybody. And they have a free choice. They don't have to pick who the party picks. They can pick anyone else. Well, except that when they wrote someone else in, they knew whose handwriting it was. They picked them up and sent them to the gulag where they died. So that's not democracy. So in order for, that's not free choice. So in order for God to have free choice, he really has to give you something to choose between. That's not a choice. That was a choice between not voting for the party and dying. It wasn't not voting for the party, voting for somebody else. So in order for God to be fair in this whole moral game, he has to give Adam and Eve at least the most fundamental choice of all, and that is, do you want to live here or not? I created you. You didn't ask to come here. I have to make it possible for you to exit this scene if you want to. And here's the key. The way I've built you, you're going to need periodic whatever these biologically active ingredients are to keep your systems integrated. If you don't want to live here, if you don't want to go with me on my trip, just don't eat of the tree and you will fade away. So people who says, it says in the Bible there will be no death there, but it says there can't be, it doesn't say that there can't be any death there. It says that there won't be. And that's a completely different statement than saying that there can't be.
So how again would they be able to live by eating the tree of life after they've eaten from the knowledge of good and evil?
Well, because we don't know what was in the tree of life, this is all supposition, and now we're getting further and further out there in Guessville, and the further you get out there in Guessville, the more likely you're wrong. Because you've had to make a number of assumptions beforehand, which you can't prove. But just following in this line of reasoning, if you needed these integrating systems to keep the, let's say, the mind working in the way it has to when you're bringing in new information, then you're constantly bringing in new information. We are importing information from our environment constantly, and that's another big argument against the evolutionists. The evolutionists are bringing it up themselves. They say that there's been far more horizontal gene transfer than there is transfer vertically. And they know that, so that this is really causing, and now they've even started looking at genes that evolve versus organisms, because, and another problem is that phenotype does not follow genotype, and they're having a major problem there, because you can have the same genotype with different phenotypes, and you can have the same, and vice versa. And so how can you use the environment selecting when the very basis that your assumption that those are intimately connected isn't true? And they know it's not true now. And I could show you number of slides, which I don't have with me in papers, which show that to be the effect. So this whole thing is a can of worms that's getting ready to explode. This is the very top levels of the genetic debate that are going back and forth. But getting back here to where I've gotten a little bit of a field here, but getting back to what you're saying, what you're asking is that, and if I'm not scratching where you're itching, stop me and get me back on the straight path. If God sets up a system like this, because it's needed for us to integrate the new information into our information systems that now become part of us forever, if he has to make this on a weekly or whatever, Isaiah says a monthly basis, we'll go to the New Jerusalem every month at least, but there will also be Sabbaths. Therefore, it must be vitally important for this to be integrated. And if you could see the integration map that I have, it's called a horror map, about how every single system in the cell is integrated with every other, and there's feedback like you can, it's mind-boggling, and it finally gets to the place where you put it down and you say it's impossible to understand this. It is complexity beyond anything that you ever could imagine. If he needs to have certain situations, like if you have a Ferrari and you have to have a friend of mine had one, you had to take it in and get it tuned up all the time, because I guess it has 12 cylinders or something, and it has all kinds of very complex moving parts which require frequent upkeep. I would argue that we are far more complex than that. So if God has it in the fruit, multiple biologically active ingredients that do that process, that then makes sense, and it allows you to go out and entrain new information, make new code or change slightly the way your code is, and then have that integrated, because if it's not integrated, you will end up with multiple operating systems over time. And that's what, you know, one reason we die is because we have two operating systems that we can clearly identify, and it leads to death. One of them overpowers the other.
I would make one other comment, and that is that Ellen White says that that Adam, as he grew older, started realizing the wisdom of the Creator in not allowing him to eat of the tree of life, that 1,000 years was enough living in a society of evil. And I think that that's one of the points that probably should be made, is that, yes, God may very well have excluded them. You may remember he promised them that when you eat it, you will die.
He says, dying you will die.
It's well, he also says, when you eat it, it's not in the day. That's a mistranslation. Yeah. And I can show you that from the Hebrew. So God says, here's your choice, and he didn't give them the third choice that you can eat out of both trees, which is exactly what the devil wanted them to do. So I think that, you know, God does not give us totally unlimited freedom of choice. He gives us choices that we're going to have to make, and sometimes the one that we'd like, that, you know, you can have your fun and it doesn't matter, that's not given us as a choice.
I don't know if I scratched where you itched, because I know no, I went all over the place, so I apologize for that.
A couple more scriptures. One is, I think it's there, where it says the greatest miracle is the, I forget exactly how it says it, though, where the mind of man is basically replaced by the mind of Christ. I mean, it's where man's mind is taken.
Let this mind which is in Christ Jesus be, I think that's, if I remember right, it's Philippians 4:11.
Yeah, it's, anyway, it says, state is the greatest miracle.
May this mind in, that was in Christ Jesus be formed in you.
And also as far as
Ephesians, it was Ephesians 4.
Okay. Also, this other one says, choose ye this day who you will serve. So the choice is there. I think one of the key things the Bible teaches us to do is humble ourselves. And in humbling ourselves, then that allows us to make the choice. But in humbling ourselves and denying our flesh, our mind, of course, is what were you talking about, is flesh. So there is a choice even there, but we would have to deny the flesh. And those neurological connections or whatnot is the flesh. We would have to stop listening to those things, and we'd have to take on the...
Well, I think I've gotten to the place where I've fatigued everyone, including myself. So I will mercifully call this to an end. But thank you for putting up. I warned them. I said, this is going to be 2 hours in length. I warned before I came down. They said, just do it. People will leave. So those of you who hung around, thank you. I'm sorry that it had to be this long. But the way this whole thing is set up, I have no choice. So,
well, we welcome you next week. And
I will be talking exactly, Dr. Brandstetter, about those curses. I think you will find out they're a lot different than you thought when you look at it from a science point of view.